At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. One guest this week, but an excellent one and a topical one, and one of the best to do it on his beat. It's Alex Sherman. He is a CNBC media reporter. If you follow that network or read that network online, you're obviously familiar with Alex's work. He's been doing a ton of stuff when it comes to the intersection of sports media and business, or sports and business, I would say. Probably just don't want to limit them to media. And we're going to get into some of the topics that have been prominent when it comes to sports media in the last 2 weeks. And with that, I bring in Alex Sherman. Alex, welcome back to the Sports Media Podcast.
Richard, it is always a pleasure.
Alex, you work very cheap for me, and I cannot thank you enough for that. All right, before we get into some of the sort of the real, you know, businessy kind of things, you know, as you know, I'm much more of a generalist and a broader kind of view on this stuff. I do want to talk about Super Bowl viewership, because that's something like my audience, like those who are not in the super weeds in terms of the business, like can understand and relate to, and like, oh, wow, look at this number. So the Super Bowl viewership averages 123.7 million viewers across all the different platforms. That shatters the previous mark of 115.1 million for last year's game. 7% increase. We will, of course, give the caveat that since 2020, we are now in an out-of-home viewing universe where Nielsen has much better data in terms of the people who are watching, like the Super Bowl in restaurants, bars, airports. So the numbers are going to be, quote-unquote, higher than they were back in the day. But this comparison is apples to apples. Last year was the exact same kind of metric, and 7% to me, Alex, is a huge, huge jump. Let's start here. I want your just sort of big picture takeaways when you saw the numbers that CBS and Nielsen put out.
So a lot of things went right, I think, for this game. Clearly, there was a Taylor Swift effect. I think female viewership, 18 to 34, was up 14.2% versus last year's. Oh, that's an overall for the playoffs, actually, not just for the Super Bowl. But I believe females even above 65
correct.
Was up.
I think almost every female demo, I think, was up just about.
Exactly. Yeah. So that helped. It was, you know, I think the game itself was very good. Two opponents who were fairly clearly evenly matched, both with their own narratives, the whole Brock Purdy Disney story, the idea of, you know, is Mahomes going to challenge Brady for, you know, one day GOAT status, all of that stuff working very well in the favor of CBS. But look, I mean, you know, the last couple of months I've been working on a documentary about ESPN and how ESPN will compete in a streaming future. And, you know, I'll sort of tease the documentary, but part of it was that I followed Joe Buck and Troy Aikman around for a little while as they prepared for Monday Night Football. And one of the things Troy Aikman told me, and that resonated with me when I was talking to him, was that we are just in a cultural moment that fits football so well. And I'm talking about all demographics. Of course, we know that football is wildly the most popular sport out there. But in terms of the younger generation that hasn't been brought up on this culture of watching these long games and sitting through advertisement, on the face of it, you might think, you know, well, football is so long with all these ads. How do they have the attention span for this? But there's so fewer games of football than there are in these other sports. And you can walk away and come back and you have betting and you have fantasy. It fits very well into the particular culture we are in now in a number of ways that I think a lot of other sports are still struggling with. And so it has such a foothold in our culture that it is really, really stark that you just see the amount of people that subscribe to traditional TV go down by the millions every single year, and yet the ratings for live football keep going up. It is quite remarkable, and the Super Bowl is yet another example of it.
Yeah, excellent point. The regular season viewership up 7%. Obviously, I just gave you the numbers for the Super Bowl. So I want to ask you a couple of specific things, and you can give me your sense of impact. How much do you think legalized gambling, or now that more states, obviously, you are able to bet in, how much do you see that as a correlation to the regular season numbers and the Super Bowl numbers being up this year?
Look, there's got to be some correlation there. To your point, it's legalized gambling is still not in the biggest media markets, or at least many of them. I mean, it's in New York now, but it's not in California yet. And certainly, you know, football is extremely popular in the South of the United States, and it's not in a lot of those states either, including Texas. So we're getting there, but like that train, I think, hasn't even fully revved up to what it may be. You'd have to imagine, though, that, I mean, it's just, again, it's the ability to bet is so easy that there's so much marketing. If you watch any of these football games or just sports channels in general, the marketing's down from what it was a couple of years ago, but it's still very prevalent that, you know, I think you'd be putting blinders on if you thought it had no effect.
Paramount Plus, literally days after getting this incredible viewership number and certainly getting additional ad revenue from the game going to overtime, I think I saw Anthony Crupie of Sportico say about $60-70 million. Yeah, maybe it's more, a touch more, maybe it's less, but it's a significant number. Literally days after this, Alex, they announced massive layoffs at Paramount Global. And, you know, if you're a layperson reading this, you're like, you got to be kidding me, right? Like, once again, more media layoffs. And two, this company just comes off a massive, you know, Super Bowl number. My sense is you probably knew that these layoffs were coming. The reason I give that exposition to the audience so that they know the background of this, does this sort of portend the sports rights holdings that Paramount Plus has that something could, in theory, happen to them where, I don't know, you know, it breaks off. Paramount tries to get into it, and we'll get into the joint venture between WBD, Fox, and ESPN. But if you could pinpoint it down, what does this mean for sports, at least from your perspective?
Paramount did not need to announce their layoffs the day after they reported blowout ratings and for the Super Bowl. So that was, you know, that was a choice that the company made. To your point, you're right. Paramount itself had foreshadowed these layoffs in an internal memo that I reported on a couple weeks ago. So even people at the company knew this was coming. They didn't know the extent of it. I reported it's about 800 employees. One thing I will say is if you line up those things, while again, superficially, you may say, look, you know, this seems kind of wild that they'd announce this great news and then sort of this terrible news. From a Wall Street standpoint, the fact of the matter is it's good news twice. Because Wall Street always loves layoffs and cost cutting. And certainly in this era, there a lot of these investors are looking to these media companies to cut costs, particularly Paramount Global, which continues to lose money on its Paramount Plus streaming service. So to get to your second part of the question, yeah, look, Paramount Global is in the midst of talks with a number of different potential buyers. This has sort of been well reported at this point, whether it's Larry Ellison's son, David, and Skydance Media wanting to potentially merge with Paramount Pictures, the movie studio, and how do you get that deal done? Or a bigger full merger with Warner Brothers Discovery, where there's been preliminary talks already, or, you know, Byron Allen lobbed in a bid. I don't know how much faith you want to put in that bid, considering he seems to just bid for every legacy media asset, and almost none of those deals come to fruition. But all you need to do is listen to CEO Bob Bakish talk about the company. And, you know, he uses coded language. He says, you know, we're here to maximize shareholder value in whatever way we can, you know, whether that's an independent company or, you know, through other means. That is clearly just code for, you know, look, like, we will sell our company.
Yeah, we're open for business.
The right price.
Right.
Right. Exactly. We're open for business. And so it's very clear that they are open for business. I think it's far less clear if a deal actually gets done, because it all comes down to the deal structure and price. You know, if Paramount Global is seen as a deteriorating asset, is a bidder going to pay today's price plus a premium on top of that in order to convince shareholders to sell? And how big will that premium need to be? These are all open questions. My sense is that nothing is imminent here. So even though these deal talks have been going on for a while, the feedback I get is that don't expect a deal within the coming days or anything like that.
Last one before we get to ESPN Fox WBD's joint venture. You're living in a fantasy world if you don't think Taylor Swift had an impact on the Super Bowl. And I'm not talking about the insane human beings who are putting the conspiracy theories and Pentagon op. I mean, you know, we'll take a break from that. But like, if you're playing that kind of content card, man, you know who you are anyway. That said, Alex, I am curious, and this is kind of the interesting thing about Taylor Swift to me in terms of how it relates to the NFL and the Super Bowl. What I don't know, honestly, and I usually feel like I have a pretty decent feel on this, but I don't have a feel on this one, is will it carry over to next year? Let's make the presumption, just for the sake of this conversation, that Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift remain a couple. You know, whether it becomes a marriage, whether fiance or just boyfriend, girlfriend, they are still connected. So the question to me would be, was this sort of thing like a one-time phenomenon where there were so many media outlets who sort of jumped on it, got great, you know, page views and ratings for it? Or is it sustainable in the fact that there will be some people who sampled the NFL, who had never sampled the NFL before because of Taylor Swift, who stick around? Do you have any feel for what this means for the 2024-25 season?
Yeah, good question. I almost think about that in the cultural sense of we are living in a moment now where Taylor Swift seems to be one of one in terms of stardom. I mean, I can't really remember the last time in the celebrity world there has been one person that has been clearly above everybody else.
I agree.
I don't, maybe like Michael Jackson.
The only other equivalent I feel in my lifetime is Michael Jackson. The only one.
Right. So that, I think, is the question, which is, a year from now, is she still in that central casting role?
Great question.
Of one star among others? And if she is, then I would imagine we will have a similar effect where we will see some carryover. But, you know, if for some reason, you know, the general public starts to get a little bit tired of it, then I imagine we'll probably see a fallback in the football ratings as well.
Imagine sleeping in the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's iconic sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code Odyssey. So head to B-O-L-L and branch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's get into something that you have covered a lot, and that's the ESPN Fox WBD plans to launch a joint streaming service this fall. For those who are not familiar with the story, and I would encourage you to go to Alex's work and read it, consumers basically have the ability to subscribe directly to what would be a new app. They would also have the ability to bundle this product with Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max. Think about it as like kind of a skinny bundle of these offerings, as opposed to you paying for like a traditional cable offering. So it's sort of ESPN and Fox and WBD. getting all of their properties together, which is a ton. Think about Fox Sports, ESPN, and WBD, what they have. I mean, NBA, you know, college football, NFL, they've got a lot of stuff. They don't have everything, but they have a lot of stuff. And their thought is to, we're going to give you this option that you can buy us directly. So again, Alex, we'll go once again, big picture. You've done a lot of reporting on this. As we talk today, like, what do you make of this? What do you make of the feasibility, and what do you make of people talking about it?
Yeah, so there's a lot of just general confusion about this still. I mean, that is the big takeaway I've had from talking to people at the leagues, the pay TV distribution world, and other media companies that are not a part of this. And to be honest, even some people that kind of are part of this. Just in the sense of, like, there's some basic unanswered questions here, beyond the fact that there's been no announced leader or even a definitive agreement among the three companies to actually incorporate this thing yet. Really, we've just had kind of a vague press release that the thing is coming and that they want to launch a skinny bundle of sports networks that include both the sports and other things that are on these linear channels, so that people, if you will get the full ABC, for instance, or the full Fox, not just the sports that air on ABC and Fox in this sports app. So some of the questions are, the pay TV distributors want to know, if these three companies sell this skinny bundle of networks, will the distributors also be allowed the same deal? And if not, they could potentially sue over MFN, most favored nation clauses that these media companies had signed with them that basically say, look, if you are going to give another distributor a better deal than us, then we want the same deal. The question would be, well, this isn't another distributor, this is themselves. So does that count? Like, are they actually breaching a contract there or not? I don't know. That is a legal question. Clearly, there are antitrust concerns here. So there, I think there's kind of no doubt that at least regulators will look at this thing to make sure that Disney, Fox, and Warner Brothers are not either hurting consumers by, you know, meshing their power together, or potentially hurting other media rivals or pay TV providers or sports leagues, whatever it may be. So that, I think, is still very much an outstanding question. It does strike me that maybe fall of 2024 is ambitious for this thing to launch, given the fact that there are so many questions. ESPN has also said they have their own direct-to-consumer product that's coming out in the fall of 2025. So that, too, is sort of a competing product to this other thing that's launching. So ESPN made two announcements, the sports JV and their streaming service, and it kind of cuts the audience for both of them. So, of course, ESPN owns one-third of the sports JV, and they own 100% of the direct-to-consumer product. Now, the economics will be different, and maybe ESPN figures the sports JV is a safer bet because since there's more content, it will look more like cable, and therefore fewer people will churn off of it, right? Fewer people will cancel out of season if their favorite sport isn't playing, for instance. Maybe that's the thinking about why to launch two of these things. But my overarching take is that there are a ton of questions about this and very few answers at this stage.
That's a great summary. Okay, so a couple of smaller things here. All of us have sort of reported on price points. My sense is probably a lot of us have talked to the same people. The sort of the price point or the logical starting price point, depending on who you read, but again, it's pretty sourced. All of us are fairly close. Between $45, let's say, and $55 per month, with potential introductory offers being lower because they're trying to entice you to sign up. So my question for you, and again, I'll ask you to put your analyst hat on here, is there enough of an audience that would pay that kind of money for this product, independent of whatever else you own, you have, Netflix, Disney Plus, et cetera? Because to me, that's the question, is like, are there enough people out there to make this a sustainable business?
So here's where we get to the part about my little reference to the fact that there were people even involved in the service itself that had questions about it. I get different answers to this question, depending on who I speak to, among the three companies involved. And I won't get into exactly who says what, because it's conversations that were not on the record. But there are some people involved with this service, the making of this service, who say, this is just a gap offering. Like, we're just trying to get as many people as we can. So it doesn't matter if there's only 1 or 2 million people that would sign up for this thing. If it's 1 or 2 million more than what we already have, then it's worth it for us to do this. There are other people I've talked to, one person in particular, who said, I expect this thing to be a monster and that it's going to be this phenomenal product that will be bundled with Disney Plus and Max. And it's going to be this, you know, earth-shattering product that millions of people sign up for, because they're going to realize that if they take this and they pair it with Paramount Plus or Peacock, that'll still be less money than what they're paying for cable. And it's really going to disrupt the industry. I can't say that I know the answer. Like, I don't have enough knowledge to say that I know the answer to this, other than the fact that I think there's a decent amount of inertia in this business. People do not like canceling their thing, especially if they've bundled it already with internet service or phone or whatever. So whenever there's a new thing that exists like this, unless it's like Disney Plus, which is the one example that comes to mind, which added 10 million subscribers in its first 24 hours. But other than that, like, it takes a while, I think, for people to warm up to it, to understand what they're buying. So my guess is that it will be at least slow starting. And look, to go back to my earlier point, I don't even know if it'll launch on time. So the whole premise to me that this thing is going to be a monster strains credulity to me. But look, what do I know?
You know a lot. All right. One last thing on ESPN in terms of the direct-to-consumer product, because it's pretty interesting to me. And again, it was Bob Iger, I believe, who announced that the ESPN direct-to-consumer product would come to consumers in 2025. And again, for those of you who don't understand what that means, it just means that you'll be able to get everything that ESPN offers directly to you as a streaming service. Like, think of you'll call it ESPN Netflix, basically, and you'll be able to subscribe to this, and you don't need cable, and you'll be able to get Monday Night Football, the college football championships games, all that stuff. Right now, everything that ESPN does is not on ESPN Plus. They're still sort of, you know, understandably playing sort of both sides here, to these parallel paths, but this product eventually gets you all of ESPN. So this is where I throw this back to you, Alex. Forgetting about the joint venture, what do you think of just ESPN as a direct-to-consumer product in 2025? Is that the monster that the company still thinks it will be? They won't have they'll have everything that ESPN has, but they don't have everything. You know what I mean? Ultimately, like, there's other networks that, you know, they don't have the NCAA basketball tournament, for like one huge example. So, no doubt there'll be millions and millions of people who subscribe to it, but just as like me being an observer, like, I don't know what the ceiling is of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's hard to figure out how much of a big monster that's going to be, let's say, if we're talking in 2030. What do you think?
Yeah, this is such a good question. Rich Greenfield, who is a media analyst.
ESPN skeptic, fair to say sometimes?
ESPN skeptic. Says there's only 20 to 30 million passionate sports fans in this country. So
it's an interesting observation, whether it's right or not.
However many people sign up for this, like, that's the ceiling in his view, because some amount of those people are not going to want to pay X amount of dollars. We still don't know how much the ESPN flagship D2C will cost. It will probably cost less than $45 to $55, which was your price for the JV. So in that sense, maybe the launch of a JV will actually be good news for ESPN from a price value standpoint, because if you come out with an ESPN streaming service and you say it's, you know, $35, the general reaction might be like, wow, that's really expensive. That's like double what I pay for Netflix. But if you announce the JV first, then you're like, oh, it's, you know, $20 less than that. Like, maybe it seems like a better price value product there. I don't know that this will be a monster for ESPN. Again, to go back to the earlier point about why they even launched the JV, like, I think ESPN, their whole track record for the last decade or so has been, let's try to stall launching this thing for as long as possible. There's a reason why ESPN is basically the last man standing. in terms of exclusive content to the traditional cable bundle. Now, that's because ESPN gets paid about $10 per month per subscriber for every person that subscribes to cable, whether or not they watch ESPN. That has been a phenomenal business for ESPN, and there is rightful skepticism that a direct-to-consumer business will be as good of a business for ESPN when you have the ability to be able to very easily cancel your ESPN direct-to-consumer service whenever you want in a much more much easier way than you would to cancel cable, which is a much stickier product. So I think ESPN is quite content for their D2C product not to be a monster, as long as the cable bundle survives. And so I think what they're hoping is that whatever that number may be, 45 million, 50 million American households will just continue to subscribe to cable. The amount of people canceling cable will at some point plateau and flatten out. That product will not go to zero, like some people think. And we will not just evolve into a full streaming universe. And or there will be some sort of streaming bundle that doesn't exist today, where ESPN's direct-to-consumer service will be, in effect, bundled with Max and Netflix and whatever other streaming service exists in a couple of years from now. And that will replace the cable bundle, and the economics will be something that resembles the cable bundle today. So it's sort of an equal switch for ESPN.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, if you were just going to start a business and I told you that I could get you 30 million subscribers to pay for what is now the existing linear, let's say, universe with ESPN, you'd be like, that business is awesome. That, congratulations, you are a multi-billionaire. The problem, of course, is it once upon a time was 100 million. And right. So, but people should not forget that, like, it's not going to go to zero. Like, there are too many people, particularly too many people over 50 years old who have disposable income who are not going to quit cable. Now, like my beloved Sports Illustrated, you know, as the years go on, you start to see the average age of the magazine go up from 50 to 55, 57. People die off. And you don't often get the same, obviously, people to resubscribe in their 20s. But Alex, like, the point is, like, this business, unless something fundamentally crazy happens, there should be a cable business still when me and you are old and gray, like in some form.
The question is, from a media strategy standpoint, do you do something where the cable business really leans into being the place that you find exclusive live programming, and the streaming business becomes the place that you find all of your on-demand entertainment? The problem is that we are now living in a world where that is not a coherent, cohesive strategy among the media companies. NBC Universal puts all their sports on Peacock. Paramount Plus puts all their sports on Paramount Plus. Max has a tier where you pay more for the sports. Disney, to this point, hasn't put their sports at all on direct-to-consumer, but, you know, now says that they will. So there may need to be some consolidation among these companies, and then perhaps a rethinking of strategy so that the cable bundle ends up having some sort of value or exclusivity. Because if everything is simply available on streaming, again, unless we get some sort of streaming bundle, there may be no clear reason for the amount of Americans that cancel cable to ever plateau. And it will just keep going down and down and down. And maybe you do eventually hit something that more or less looks like zero, in part because the pay TV distributors themselves are like, there's such little profit in this for me. Like, I make all my money on high-speed broadband or whatever. At this point, the world is more or less over to streaming to begin with. Why are we even offering this thing anymore? We'll just stop offering it. We'll lay off all the people that work in the distribution business, and we'll move on with our lives.
Yeah, that's where Charter sort of had the leverage over ESPN. And I think this is what you just described is what Moffat and Nathanson calls cheating, right? It's the cheaters, basically, who they're throwing some of the great content on streaming as well as cable, and everybody's got to pay for it twice.
Yeah.
Where Disney's held off.
Well, just briefly, like, I get why they call them cheaters, but, like, they're not cheating.
Well, property, right? They can make the call.
Yeah. I mean, there's no rule against
it. I know.
Like,
I think
they're double charged.
They're just using.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah, I love those guys. They're just using it as a buzzword. But yes, you're correct. Like, ultimately, at the end of the day, they can do what they want.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
All right, lastly, we'll finish up on this, and it does get to, again, it gets to everything we're talking about in terms of, you know, what is your portfolio and where do you put your portfolio? This is the college football playoff agreement, The Athletic, my colleague Andrew Marshan and my other college football colleagues, they just reported this out. 6 years, $7.8 billion rights extension pending, still a whole sort of issue. So this is not finalized, but it seems like this is where we're heading, where ESPN will have the playoffs for the next 6 years. And then the key, Alex, here is that they can sublicense the games to other networks. So two questions for you. One, as a sports guy, like, what do you think of the deal? And then two, and this is just my interpretation of it, I cannot see how they don't sublicense it, because one, I think that's best for the college football playoffs, which is what they would want. And two, if you're ESPN, don't you got to try to recoup like some money outside somewhere? Now, lastly, this is a long, too filibustery of question for me. I don't know what the value is of like the number, you know, number 12 seed versus the number 4 seed. Like, that's the interesting question is, like, I mean, and conceptually, yeah, if it's Ohio State versus like Oklahoma, that game could be awesome. If it's like Tulane 1 year who has a great year, right, versus, you know, Bowling Green, well, the rights value, that's not so hot. So that's what's interesting to me. By the way, just so people don't yell at me, I know I didn't mention some Power 5 teams. I get it. Just put your Power 5 teams into where I said Tulane and Bowling Green.
Yeah, look, I mean, some of this, again, is a bet on, I think, from ESPN's standpoint, that in order to stay relevant against the much deeper pocketed big tech companies, the ESPN strategy is simply lock up as many sports rights of significance as I can for as long as I can. And if I do that, then I'll be able to stay relevant, whether we're living in a cable world or a streaming world. Like, you're still going to get some audience that is going to need to subscribe to ESPN when it comes down to, in this case, college playoff football season. So I do think that ESPN will take advantage of the sublicensing to recoup some of their money. I also do wonder how much competition there really was for this whole package.
I agree.
To begin with, because I think ESPN needs it way more than any of the other
100%
outlets out there. So this may have been a case where they were sort of bidding against themselves. I don't know that for sure. There is a reason why ESPN did this deal. It very much fits their strategy. They want to be the home to as many sports as possible while also living in a world where they are going to need to be a little bit more rational about the money that they spend on all sports. College football is a safe bet for them. Yes, they may be dealing with some games here or there in the playoffs that may end up to be clunkers. But by and large, after the NFL or maybe the NBA, college football is certainly right there as your number 2/3 safe bet sport. The ratings are going to be strong for it. It's going to draw an audience, has a huge, rabid fan base. So in essence, like, I think the deal makes sense for ESPN. I think it makes sense for the NCAA. And I think ESPN will be in a mode of trying to figure out any way they can to remain profitable and to have a healthy balance sheet in this world we're entering, where suddenly the bidders for all of the marquee sports will change from the broadcast networks to Apple, Amazon, Google, and probably Netflix, even though we're not there yet.
Yeah, everything you said is a great takes. Again, it goes without saying, although we'll say it, like college football fits into ESPN's sort of overall philosophy, even if you think get into the SEC network and the ACC network. It also sets them up geographically to be in places that they must be in to get money. It is essentially, I hate to sort of use, I won't even say sort of say that. It essentially is their Southern and Southwest and sort of Big Ten Midwestern strategy as a company, because it gets them consumers in those places where not necessarily, you know, the NBA, the NFL is everywhere, but you're just NBA or Major League Baseball. So I'm with you. I think they have made themselves essentially the home of college sports in America. And it would... To wrap this property up is so much more important to them than if it's Fox, right, or anybody else. It's just it's their philosophy essentially as a business.
Yeah, right. There was a separate deal that ESPN inked earlier this year, which was like I want to say it's a $915 million. I'll have to look that up, or people at home can look it up. But it was a long-term deal, and it was for basically all the other NCAA sports, you know, and some of those sports are getting to be more and more popular. Women's basketball.
Totally. Example. Yep.
So you're 100% right. They want to be the home of college sports. They want those sports to live in their whatever streaming
ecosystem, right,
world they come up with.
And they want NBC and Fox, and they're trying to make sure that they don't get it as much as anything else, right?
Correct. Exactly. It keeps them viable for as long as possible.
Yeah, 100%. Alex, you should have a podcast. I keep always saying this. Alex Sherman is a CNBC media reporter and an excellent one. Check out his work on all of CNBC's different platforms. He's been doing phenomenal work when it comes to the joint venture, as we talked about in this podcast, between ESPN, Fox, and WBD. He'll be leading, along with some other reporters, I think, that coverage. So if you are interested in that joint venture, and if you're listening to this podcast, you absolutely are, because you're going to probably have to make a decision at some point as a consumer. Am I willing to put my money into this thing, or am I going to continue to play the game where I'm just going to get all these different streaming services? Some of this is really just about your own diehard nature of being a national sports fan. And by the way, maybe I'll bring Alex back one day for this. This doesn't even include how you feel about your own local team or regional team, which is a whole different, Alex, like, payment that you must make.
Richard, this is very simple. Just keep paying for cable and pay my CNBC salary.
Yes. Like, I am a proud... although you don't get any of this, Alex, because I'm paying in a different country right now, but I'm a proud cable subscriber in Toronto. But if I lived in the United States, trust me, I would still be getting cable. I think, at least for some of us, you realize, not that I love the cable companies per se, but man, what a deal it was in hindsight for all the entertainment and sports that you got. Alex, please come back. I always enjoy when you're on, and thank you so much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Anytime, Richard.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Alex Sherman. He's always excellent, and try to have him back more. Just always good on this stuff and very plugged in, and has some interesting takes on where the future of sports media is. If you like these podcasts, head to the archives page. Please leave us a 5-star review and a nice note. That is how this podcast continues. Last couple ones, Kenny Smith, the longtime Inside the NBA studio host, Noah Eagle, who came on this podcast to talk about what it was like to call the Super Bowl on Nickelodeon. Did some, obviously, football content, a ton of football content leading into the Super Bowl. If you like hockey, Ray Ferraro and Sean McDonough were on this podcast not too long ago. If you like college football, Paul Feinbaum was a guest recently. And if you're into the business side, we had Karen Brodkin and Hillary Mandel, who are the deal makers for Endeavor when it comes to negotiating for the NCAA and stuff like that. Thank you to Patrick Antonetti, always working hard for me, and I do not take that for granted. Excellent producer. Thank you to Odyssey and everybody there for their support. And thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers? That's a butterfly effect forever.